Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, Professor John White. Hello there.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
And we're really pleased to say that we're resuming our conversation with Dr. Sephora Tang from Canada. Hi, Sephora.
Hello.
Sephora is a psychiatrist, and we've been talking last week about how euthanasia kind of came to be legalized in Canada and how the kind of eligibility criteria have been gradually expanding and slipping, including in likely in the near future to expand to people who are only suffering from mental health conditions. Sephora, I wanted to dig a bit more into your experience as a psychiatrist working in this kind of new normal in Canada. Does it come up often in your day-to-day work? Do you find patients either kind of asking you for MAID or colleagues recommending that this patient or that patient might be eligible?
Well, because the law has not yet expanded yet to include mental illness legally, so the requests have not been coming in to that extent yet. But I do know that I have some patients who are already contemplating it and have asked me about it. And so I will speak to them because I want to understand their underlying reasons for why they're wanting to access medical assistance in dying, or MAID is an acronym that we use in Canada. I usually approach this as any other request, when we assess for suicidal ideations in patients and they respond affirmatively, I still have a duty as a psychiatrist to understand what that is. And my approach is that a request for medical assistance in dying is an expression of somebody's suicidal ideations. And so the first step to do that is just to try to understand what their underlying distress is and see if we can address those things. And oftentimes what I hear is this overwhelming sense of loneliness and isolation, fear of the unknown, fear of not being supported, fear of losing the support of their caregivers, and what are they going to do? And I've had conversations like this, and I suggested, well, what if we can help you with some of these things? What if we can help you to find some supportive living and people can help you with paying the bills and the finances and ensure that your needs are taken care of and that you can eat? Would that change your mind? And oftentimes it would. They would sort of retract their desire to continue accessing an assisted death. Unfortunately, with this law now coming down the pipes and patients becoming aware of it, are saying, well, I'm just going to wait until the law changes and then I'm going to access it anyway. And they're speaking in a time when they're feeling emotionally distressed. And I've heard some of my patients say to me, if medical assistance in dying was not available for mental illness, then yes, I would try these other supports first. But if it was available, I think I would just rather opt for an assisted death before trying these alternative routes. And the concerning thing about the Canadian law is that patients do not have a legal, it's not mandated legally that they try all available treatments. They could decline treatment. For example, someone who has cancer does not want to receive chemotherapy and still be made eligible for an assisted death. And if you apply this to mental illness, it becomes even more concerning that we would offer essentially an assisted suicide if a patient has declined certain standard treatments. Now, obviously, that's not the policy that we want to be, enacting, but legally, from a legal perspective, there's nothing that could stop a patient from accessing a medically assisted death if their physician, so again, this is the subjective determination of the assessor, feels like it would be appropriate for that patient to decline treatment and still access a medically assisted death. So I think this is the reason why there needs to be stricter and better standards to guide. And this is currently missing in the Canadian legal context.
And could you say what's happening in your own hospital outside of the psychiatric areas, in the areas where there may be patients with cancer or with motor neurone disease we talked about last week, who feel that their life is not worth living, and who are physicians routinely raising this as an option? Or are they waiting for the patient to raise this? How is it actually working in practice?
So I think this is an area that's a bit contentious, because do bear in mind that under the law, it is still a crime to sort of persuade somebody to end their life, you know, as a suicide, an assisted suicide. You know, the law carved out that it's legal under certain parameters. So how do you interpret this within like a clinical setting then? If a physician is going to raise this unsolicited, how much of that is perceived or experienced by the patient as someone that is encouraging their suicide? And so I'm not going to speak for my hospital specifically, but we do know that patients have had experiences where physicians have raised the option of medically assisted death unsolicited. And I guess there's two different views on this, but I know at our college level, like the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, which grants physicians our license to practice, they recently had a consultation on medical assistance in dying. And if you read the policy that they're consulting on, it's very clear that they sort of expect, they quoted a CAMAP, so that CAMAP is the Canadian, I forget what it stands for, but it's the Association of Canadian Physicians that provide, made, and assess for medically assisted death. But that document very strongly recommended that that physicians do initiate the discussion and to put medically assisted death on the table, even without the patients soliciting it or inquiring about it, if the physician felt that this was an appropriate, like, you know, if they met the legal criteria for it, and that it was appropriate that the physician themselves should raise it. So this raises many more new concerns about how this would affect the patient-physician dynamic. I mean, if you were the father of a child who, you know, above the age of 18, an adult, but had a mental illness and was severely depressed, and you took them to see your family doctor or the psychiatrist, and you're expecting that the physician is going to try to help your daughter, and the physician turns around and, you know, depending on the trajectory of your daughter's case, then proposing that assisting in her suicide would be an appropriate response to her suffering, I think most parents would be rightly concerned that this could be a scenario that they would face. If you add on another disability to your daughter's presentation, you know, maybe she got in a car accident and she's suffering from a traumatic brain injury. You know, this could happen to any of us. How does a physician who is working in a system where medically assisted death is legal then perceive the quality of life or the value of the life of your daughter? What if she was paraplegic, you know? How much easier is it then to suggest, well, it looks like you're suffering a lot. You do have depression and you are suicidal and you're clearly telling me that you want to die. Why don't we consider that as a possibility?
And I think this is, it illustrates again, this extraordinary difficulty about the law and operating within a legal framework, because the situation is exactly analogous to what happens in the UK concerning abortion, where if the patient meets the criteria for an abortion, because, for instance, the unborn baby, the fetus, has some kind of abnormality, and if the obstetrician fails to inform the patient that they meet the law, then the obstetrician will be sued, or may be sued, can be sued by the patient subsequently that they were not informed. So once an option, a medical option becomes legally available, there becomes an implicit duty. You have to tell the patient. So the analogous situation would be, I've got cancer, I've got terrible pain, I go to see my physician tells me about all this pain relief medication and so on, but fails to tell me that I could have euthanasia, that I could be killed, even though I do meet. And it's only a year later that I discover that I could have been had the euthanasia a year ago. I can then sue the physician because I've had a year of additional pain that I didn't know anything about. So this is the problem, yeah. Isn't it?
And that was actually incorporated into the policy, and I'm not sure that whoever crafted the policy was necessarily thinking about, you know, how this would affect patients who have mental illness. They said that you need to inform them or even like make a referral for a medically assisted death in a timely fashion, essentially to reduce any further unnecessary suffering, I guess. However, when we're dealing with psychiatric illnesses or even, you know, brain injuries, the time to recover takes time. There's no other way around it. And oftentimes, if you're trying to overcome a mental illness and going through the recovery route, the experience of that is painful. Sometimes things have to get worse before it feels better, and doing that work, facing and confronting things that we've tried to keep suppressed and buried and just rather not think about, it's tough. And many people would say, who suffer from both a physical illness and an emotional or psychological illness, would say that I can deal with the physical pain, but the psychological suffering is really the thing that undoes me. And so I don't want to minimize psychological suffering because it is very painful, you know. And but I still question whether the approach to helping somebody experience that distress and helping them through it, whether our approach to offer death as a solution is the best solution. Well, the thing is, if the colleges expect us to provide a medically assisted death in a timely manner, we are not allowing patients the time that they would need to actually recover. So how many patients would we be, you know, ending their lives unnecessarily when they could have had a chance to recover if we had just given them that time and be able to help them to bear that suffering in that time with the hope that they are going to get through this? And we know that to be able to predict accurately that the person in front of you who's suffering from a mental illness is not going to get better, to be able to make that determination, we can't. It's guesswork, right? Mm-hmm. So the way that the law is crafted is, in order to be eligible for an assisted death, you have to make the determination that the illness that the person is experiencing is irremediable. That is the key term. But we actually don't have any ability to determine accurately that a person with mental illness has an irremediable illness. And I was just saying to your dad earlier, I can't predict that in my patients. There are some who have been considering having a medically assisted death, and then a year later they come back to me. Nothing has really changed externally in their circumstances, But with all the time that has been invested in helping them to learn more about themselves, to become more accepting, to be more self-compassionate, internally they experienced a shift and they recognized that there was still meaning and purpose in their life and that they didn't have to be, you know, perceived as a burden, that they still had something to offer. And that shifted them from wanting to die to then finding new reason to live. But that took about a year for them to get to that level. And all I did as a psychiatrist was just simply to be there with them, to witness to their suffering, to hold a safe space for them so that they could work through these things internally. And that was what made the difference. Can I predict that this is going to happen? I can't. Some patients might not reach that, or they might need 10 years in order to reach that stage. As a physician, I don't have a crystal ball to tell me what is going to happen.
That's right. And certainly working as a doctor, you see that time and time again, don't you, that how utterly unpredictable the future is, how people can change their diseases, both physical and psychiatric, can change dramatically. And this idea that we can say, oh, this one is hopeless, we absolutely know this is irredeemable. Again, irremediable. It doesn't make sense, does it, when we're actually practicing on the ground?
Yeah, and what kind of messaging does that give to our patients too? If the physician is expected to say, I can assist you with an earlier death, does that not imply that you have kind of given up and that the physician themselves has lost hope that they're going to get better? I mean, that's a pretty devastating message to receive. If I was a patient, I would like my physician to be firmly grounded and say, like, no matter what happens, I'm going to walk with you through this. We'll keep working on this together. That would give me hope. To be given the message, well, if all else fails, then I can just help you to end your life. That's not very hope-inspiring.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned earlier, which was that you decided in yourself as a psychiatrist that you weren't going to recommend MAID for any of your patients. You didn't believe that it was the kind of compassionate thing to do as their physician. How is that decision, is that decision possible? Do you have the right of conscientious objection? Are you obliged to kind of hand a patient over to a more pro-MAID colleague of yours? And how is the kind of college in Ontario responding to doctors like yourself who are trying to opt out of the whole system?
So that's an excellent question. Within the law, I mean, there's the preamble to Bill C-14. It said that no doctor should who doesn't want to be involved in these procedures, they don't need to be. However, the way that the colleges have framed their expectations is that even if you have a conscientious objection to being implicated in medically assisted death in terms of, you know, inserting the lethal syringe yourself, we still have a duty to refer our patient who is requesting this to a colleague who would be able to provide for that service. And so this is something that we've been trying to fight in court unsuccessfully. The court actually did not, so this was the Court of Ontario, did not rule on the issue of conscience, but only on religion, and said that even if a physician has religious beliefs that indicate they have moral objections to euthanasia-assisted suicide, it's okay to infringe upon the religious beliefs of the physicians because the patient's rights take precedent. And so they didn't actually talk about conscience per se, but my response to that would be, why are you enacting policies that suppress the conscience of physicians? Conscience being what one knows or believes to be right and wrong. And so what are the policy implications of this if you're telling physicians that they must suppress their judgment about what is right and wrong, and encourage them to do something that they believe is bad for their patients or wrong. This, at a very fundamental core level, is something that puts patients' safety at risk. And so at this point, it really becomes an individual question then for the physician. How do they expect to carry themselves under these circumstances, and how are they going to choose to respond when the college is expecting them to do something that they believe is morally reprehensible?
And do you think if the government were to pass this further amendment to allow medical killing, euthanasia, in cases of pure mental illness without any other physical problem, how do you feel personally, Savora? Do you think it's going to be possible for you and for other psychiatrists who believe as you do to carry on practicing in your position? Is it putting you in an impossible position? I mean, I know that's a pretty hard question to ask, but what's your thinking about it?
So, you know, when I first graduated, I had thought of working in psychosocial oncology, actually, because I saw the value in journeying with people even to the very end and helping to prepare people for a good death in terms of working out all the psychological kinks that they might have. I decided not to pursue that just because when I graduated in 2015, I knew that this law was coming down, and I thought, well, to work in palliative care, I would just be walking into the lion's den at that point. And I would probably have to face these scenarios a lot more frequently. So let's just do general psychiatry. But you know, you can't run away from these things. So it has, the issue has pursued me even in my profession. And to be honest, it's very tempting to say, you know, I'm just going to give up. I don't want to have to deal with this. Why not just work in another profession, like therapy, you know, as counseling? The only reason why I have a legal ability to end a person's life is because of my medical license. And if that's the case, and I didn't go into medicine to kill people, why would I want to continue working in this? And I have colleagues who have left the province of Ontario originally when this law came out, and they were really unfriendly towards people who had issues of conscience about this. I've had colleagues who have left. I've had colleagues who have stopped working in palliative care. I've had colleagues who have retired early because they don't want to have to deal with this. But, you know, I'm still early in my career. I still have a long ways to go. And I think giving up would just be taking the easy way out. And so I do intend to continue working in this field as long as it's possible. If my license isn't taken away from me, I don't want to stop working. I believe that my work is meaningful and that I am making a difference in people's lives. And some of my patients who had previously considered a medically assisted death thanked me and said, "Thank you for the work that you're doing. You are literally saving lives." Sometimes I don't even realize the impact that I'm having, but when I hear the feedback like this from some of my patients, and I recognize how important it was for me to be there in order to help them or to facilitate that internal shift that they had, I recognize that the work that I am doing is important. And so I do intend to continue and work in the system and try to make it better, right? And how can we change the culture so that people also realize the reasons why I believe what I believe and why I approach clinical care the way I do? I do this because I believe that it is better for the patients. It's better for society. It's better for our communities. That's why I do it, and I'll try to continue doing this as long as I can.
It's great to hear, and I'd really support and encourage you to do that. You know, in a Christian context, we're called to be salt and light in a society, and why I think those two metaphors are so encouraging is that actually you only need a tiny bit of salt to have a huge preservative influence, and you only need a tiny bit of light to illuminate an awful lot of darkness. So the fact that as Christians who are trying to uphold the value of human life, we may feel like a tiny minority, doesn't mean that we can't have actually an influence outside much greater than we might imagine. I mean, one of the things we're talking about in the UK is if a law like this was passed, would it be possible to create euthanasia-free zones? Would it be possible, for instance, to have clinics which were publicly stated that we don't offer euthanasia, it's a safe place? You know, would it be possible to have hospitals, independent mm-hmm. hospitals, which preserved life and took this view?
That is a wonderful idea, and that is something that I personally would like to further advance. I know that having safe spaces and sanctuaries like this that are life-affirming is under threat because, you know, in Ontario we have Catholic hospitals that provide healthcare according to the values of the Catholic Christian faith, and so euthanasia would be very contrary to that. However, when these hospitals are publicly funded, there's a lot of pressure from the government to say, unless you do exactly what we tell you to do, and if this is a legal procedure, then you must do it, otherwise we're going to remove your funding, which has happened, by the way, at a Delta Hospice in British Columbia, where the board of directors did not want to allow euthanasia on their premises, and public funding was removed from them. And so this has been an ongoing battle. But you're right, I think if we were to have a system where euthanasia and assisted suicide is legal, patients deserve to have a place where they feel safe, an environment where they feel like they do not have to worry that their patient, that the physician is going to put unsolicited on the table an assisted death as a potential solution or treatment option for them. And I think that this is something that our society should be requesting, you know. Can we not make room for having people of both sides and for those who want to be life-affirming, that they're given the space and the safety to be able to do that without feeling like they're being discriminated against? I think in a progressive society where we're supposed to be tolerant of all different views, this is probably the least thing that we could do to be able to respect everybody's opinions on this very contentious issue.
That's absolutely right. And what's more, I have a suspicion that if it was possible to create those safe places, those institutions would turn out to be incredibly popular. I think the great, you know, mass of the public would beat a path to the door to be
yes.
looked after by physicians and nurses and other professionals who they knew were committed to human life. I mean, this is not a tiny minority interest. I mean, that's the paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be possible for this threat that's coming, which is coming around the world, to actually represent a new opportunity for developing distinctively, quotes, pro-life establishments which value human life. And in some ways we're putting the clock back to many noble Christian institutions in the past.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I mean, even if you were to look at non-Christians, like the Hippocratic Oath that we used to have to take as medical professionals, that has been changed. I don't think Hippocrates was Christian, but he recognized that there was an importance, there was a value in not intentionally ending the lives of his patients, even when he was requested to do so by the patient. And so he was living in a time when people could approach their doctors and be poisoned, or, you know, the doctors were the ones who held the knowledge of what could kill and what could save life. And so preserving that ethics of life is precious, and we will not violate that. I think he probably had a pretty successful medical practice. And so we should not forget some of these earlier tenets that, you know, Western civilization has been built upon, some of these fundamental principles. It is for the good of society. And I truly believe that if the government was adaptable enough and tolerant enough to set up some of these life-affirming sanctuaries, it would help to retain a lot of people within the medical professional, including nurses and pharmacists who went into the practice of medicine because they value life and want to protect it and preserve it. And then it would be a win for the patients as well and their families who feel like they have a safe place to go. So can we not just work together to build a society that is just inclusive of everybody? And I think that that would actually build a much stronger society and a healthier society.
We're kind of running out of time, but before we end that, I wanted to ask just briefly, you know, we've been talking about this, the kind of difficult road that lies ahead for you as a Christian life-affirming doctor in Canada over at the start of your career. How do you feel like the Canadian church has been engaged in this story? Do you feel kind of upheld and encouraged and supported by Christians outside of the medical world? Have Christians been engaged in the activism and, you know, now the law has changed in work to try and mitigate and the things we've been talking about mitigating some of the harmful effects of me?
Well, I think even within the Christian realm, there are differing views on this issue. So I wouldn't say that even within the Christian faith communities that there's necessarily consensus there either. But I would say that most of the Christian leaders that I have spoken to have been very supportive of the work that I've been doing and have been trying to provide messaging to the government to be, you know, tolerant and accepting of our views. But the Canadian government thus far has not really really taken those concerns, I believe, to heart, really. I mean, you can see by the ongoing progression and the erosion of the laws that that's kind of where they're coming from. But, you know, within my own faith community, I would say that generally speaking, I feel like I've been pretty well supported. And I just want to comment on the previous comment about being light and salt. And I just really love that analogy as salt being a preservative. And we are called to be those, the light and the salt. And just a little bit, but a little bit can go a long ways. And each of us carry a light within us. And when we come together, that light becomes even stronger and brighter. And I believe that it is in this moment in time in this history where we really need to be really authentic witnesses to what we believe to be true and good. And if we individually remain firm to that, we can make a difference. So, you know, the message is, don't be afraid. We're going to get through this. And, you know, we're called to bring hope to people. And I think we can do that when we are best authentic witnesses to what we truly believe.
Well, that's a great place to draw our conversation to a close. Thanks so much, Sephora. It's been really fascinating for me personally, and I'm sure for everyone listening to get such an insight, such a thoughtful reflection on what it's like working as a psychiatrist in Canada at the moment. Thanks so much for all your insight and generosity with your time. If anyone listening would like to kind of dig into more into these questions around euthanasia and assisted suicide, as I mentioned last week, there are plenty of resources to read on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can get in touch with us, as always, by emailing molad@premier.org. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Hello, Tim here. Just before we go, I wanted to let you know we're planning a special episode in the next month or so to mark the one-year anniversary of relaunching Matters of Life and Death as part of the Premier Unbelievable Network. We're going to be dedicating an episode, or maybe even two, to answering questions from you, our listeners. They can be on any topic, perhaps something you've heard us talk about over the last year that you'd like to go deeper into, or maybe instead there's a new development in the news or science that you'd be interested to hear us chat about. We can't promise to answer every question we get, but we're definitely going to try to squeeze in as many as possible into this special omnibus episode. Nothing's out of bounds, so do get in touch now by emailing molad, M-O-L-A-D, @premier.org.uk. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.